high-ceilinged chamber. It's high enough that its ceiling is nearly lost in shadow, and its length stretches farther than her eye can see. And all along the walls of this chamber, in neat rows that stack up to the ceiling, there are dozens, hundreds, of strange square holes. She is reminded of the chambers in a wasp's nest, except the shape is wrong. And in every one of them is a body. Shafa isn't far ahead. Somewhere in this room, no longer moving forward. Nasun stops too, apprehension finally overwhelming her driving need to find Shafa. The silence makes her skin prickle. She cannot help fear. The analogy of the wasp's nest has stayed with her. And on some level, she fears looking into the cells to find a grub staring back at her. Perhaps atop the corpse of some creature, person, it has parasitized. Inadvertently, she looks into the nearest cell. It's barely wider than the shoulders of the man within, who seems to be asleep. He's youngish, gray-haired, a mid-ladder, wearing the burgundy uniform that Nasun has heard of but never seen. He's breathing, although slowly. The woman in the cell beside him is wearing the same uniform, though she's completely different in every other way. An East Coaster with completely black skin, hair that has been braided along her scalp in intricate patterns, and wine-dark lips. There is the slightest of smiles on those lips, as if even in sleep, she cannot lose the habit of it. Asleep and more than asleep. Nasun follows the silver and the people in the cells, feeling out their nerves and circulation, and understands that each is in something like a coma. She thinks maybe normal comas aren't like this, though. None of these people seem to be hurt or sick. And within each guardian, there is that shard of coarse stone, quiescent here, instead of angrily flaring like the one in Shafa. Strangely, the silver threads in each guardian are reaching out to the ones around them, networking together, bolstering each other maybe, charging one another to perform some sort of work, the way a network of obelisks does. She cannot guess. They were never meant to continue. But then, from the center of the vaulted room, perhaps 100 feet farther in, she hears a sharp mechanical whirr. She jumps and stumbles away from the cells, darting a quick frightened look around to see if the noise has awakened any of the cells' occupants. They don't stir. She swallows and calls softly, "Shafa?" Her answer, echoing through the high chamber, is a low, familiar groan. Nasun stumbles forward, her breath catching. It's him. Down the middle of the strange chamber stand contraptions, arranged in rows. Each consists of a chair attached to a complex arrangement of silver wire in loops and spars. She's never seen anything like it. You have. Each contraption seems big enough to hold one person, but they're all empty. And, Nasun leans closer for a better look, then shivers, each rests against a stone pillar that holds an obscenely complicated mechanism. It's impossible not to notice the tiny scalpels, the delicate forceps-like attachments of varying sizes, and other instruments clearly meant for cutting and drilling. Somewhere nearby, Shafa groans. Nasun pushes the cutting things out of her thoughts and hurries down the row to stop in front of the room's lone occupied wire chair. The chair has been adjusted somehow. Shafa sits in it, but he is face down, his body suspended by the wires, his chopped-off hair parting around his neck. The mechanism behind the chair has come alive, extending up and over his body in a way that feels predatory to her. But it is already retracting as she approaches. The bloodied instruments disappear into the mechanism. She hears more faint whirring sounds, cleaning, maybe. One tiny tweezer-like attachment remains, however. holding up a prize that still glistens faintly with Shafa's blood. A little metal shard, irregular and dark. Hello, little enemy. Shafa isn't moving. Nasun stares at his body, shaking. She cannot bring herself to shift her perception back to the silver threads, back to magic, to see if he is alive. The bloody wound high on the back of his neck has been neatly stitched, right over the other old scar that she has always wondered about. It's still bleeding, but it's clear the wound was inflicted quickly and sealed nearly as fast. Like a child willing the monster under the bed to not exist, Nasun wills Shafa's back and sides to move. They do as he draws in a breath.
Nasun, he croaks.
Shafa! Shafa! She flings herself to her knees and scooches forward to look at his face from underneath the wire contraption, heedless of the blood still dripping down the sides of his neck and face. His eyes, his beautiful white eyes, are half open. And they are him this time. She sees that and bursts into tears herself. Shafa, are you okay? Are you really okay? His speech is slow, slurred. Nasun will not think about why.
Nasun, I...
Even more slowly, his expression shifts, a sea quake in his brows, sending a tsunami of slow realization across the rest. His eyes widen.
There's no pain.
She touches his face. The thing is out of you, Shafa. That metal thing. He shuts his eyes, and her belly clenches, but then the furrow vanishes from his brow. He smiles again, and for the first time since Nasun met him, there is nothing of tension or falsehood in it. He isn't smiling to ease his pain or others' fears. His mouth opens. She can see all his teeth. He's laughing, although weakly. He's weeping, too, with relief and joy. And it is the most beautiful thing she's ever seen. She cups his face, mindful of the wound on the back of his neck, and presses her forehead against his, shaking with his soft laughter. She loves him. She just loves him so much. And because she's touching him, because she loves him, because she is so attuned to his needs and his pain and making him happy, her perception slips into the silver. She doesn't mean for it to. She just wants to use her eyes to savor the sight of him looking back at her, and her hands to touch his skin, and her ears to hear his voice. But she is Origin, and she can no longer shut off the Sasuna than she can sight or sound or touch. Which is why her smile falters and her joy vanishes. Because the instant she sees how the network of threads within him is already beginning to fade, she can no longer deny that he is dying. It's slow. He could last a few weeks or months, perhaps as much as a year with what's left. But where every other living thing churns forth its own silver almost by accident, where it flows and stutters and gums up the works between cells, there is nothing between his cells but a trickle. What's left in him mostly runs along his nervous system, and she can see a glaring, gaping emptiness at what used to be the core of his silver network, in his Sesapine. Without his core stone, as he warned her, he will not last long. Shafa's eyes have drifted shut. He's asleep, exhausted by pushing his weakened body through the streets. But he isn't the one who did that, is he? Nasun gets to her feet, shaking, keeping her hands on Shafa's shoulders. His heavy head presses against her chest. She stares at the little metal shard bitterly, understanding at once why Father Earth did this to him. It knows she means to bring the moon down, and that this will create a cataclysm far worse than the shattering. It wants to live. It knows Nasun loves Shafa. and that until now she has seen destroying the world as the only way to give him peace. Now, however, it has remade Shafa, offering him to Nasun as a kind of living ultimatum. Now he is free. The earth taunts by this wordless gesture. Now he can have peace without death. And if you want him to live, little enemy, there is only one way. Steel never said it couldn't be done, only that it shouldn't. Maybe Steel is wrong. Maybe as a stone eater, Shafa won't be alone and sad forever. Steel is mean and awful, which is why no one wants to be with him. But Shafa is good and kind. Surely he will find someone else to love. Especially if all the world is stone eaters too. Humanity, she decides, is a small price to pay for Shafa's future. Hoa says that Nasun has gone underground to warrant where the guardians lie. And the panic of this is sour in your mouth as you trot around the hole looking for a way in. You don't dare ask Hoa to simply transport you to her. Greyman's allies lurk everywhere now, and they will kill you as surely as they did Lerna. Allies of Hoa are present too. You have a blurry memory of seeing two streaking mountains crash into one another, one driving the other off. But until this business with the moon is settled, going into the earth is too dangerous. All of the Stone Eaters are here, Eusess. 1,000 human-sized mountains in and underneath Core Point, some of them watching you run through the streets looking for your daughter. All of their ancient factions and private battles will come to a head tonight, one way or another. Kyaka and the others have followed you, though more slowly. They do not feel your panic. At last you spot one pylon building that's been opened, cut open, it seems, as if with an enormous knife. Three irregular slashes, and then someone has made the door fall outward. It's a foot thick. But beyond it is a wide, low-ceilinged corridor going down into darkness. Someone's climbing out of it, though, as you reach it, and stumble to a halt. Nasun, you blurt, because it's her. The girl framed by the doorway is taller than you remember by several inches. Her hair is longer now, braided back in two plaits that fall behind her shoulders. You barely recognize her. She stops short at the sight of you, a faint wrinkle of confusion between her brows. And you realize she's having trouble recognizing you, too. Then realization comes, and she stares as if you are the last thing in the world she expected to see. Because you are. Hi, Mama, Nasun says. 14. I, at the end of days. I am a witness to what follows. I will tell this as such. I watch you and your daughter face each other for the first time in 2 years across a gulf of hardship. Only I know what you both have been through. Each of you can judge the other only on presences, actions, and scars, at least for now. You, much thinner than the mother she last saw when she decided to skip creche one day. The desert has weathered you, drying your skin. The acid rain has bleached your locks to a paler brown than they should be, and the gray shows more. The clothes that hang from your body are also bleached by ash and acid, and the empty right sleeve of your shirt has been knotted. It dangles, obviously empty, as you catch your breath. And also a part of Nasun's first impression of the post-rifting you. Behind you stands a group of people who all stare at Nasun, some of them with palpable wariness. You, though, show only anguish. Nasun is as still as a stone eater. She's grown only 4 inches since the rifting, but it looks to you like a foot. You can see the advent of adolescence upon her early, but that is the nature of life in lean times. The body takes advantage of safety and abundance when it can. And the 9 months she spent in Jekiti were good for her. She's probably going to start menstruating within the next year if she can find enough food. The biggest changes are immaterial, though. The wariness in her gaze, nothing like the shy diffidence you remember. Her posture, shoulders back, feet braced and square. You told her to stop slouching a million times, and yes, she looks so tall and strong now that she's standing up straight. So beautifully strong. Her orogeny sits on your awareness like a weight upon the world, rock steady and precise as a diamond drill. Evil earth, you think. She says is just like you. It's over before it's begun. You sense that as surely as you sense her strength. And both make you desperate. I've been looking for you, you say. You've raised your hand without thinking about it. Your fingers open and twitch and close and open again in a gesture that is half grasping, half plea. Her gaze goes hooded. I was with Daddy. I know, I couldn't find you. It's redundant, obvious. You hate yourself for babbling. Are you... all right? She looks away, troubled, and it bothers you that her concern so plainly isn't you. I need to. My guardian needs help. You go stiff. Nasun has heard from Shafa of what he was like before Mayoff. She knows, intellectually, that the Shafa you knew and the Shafa she loves are wholly different people. She's seen a fulcrum and the ways in which it warped its inmates. She remembers how you used to go stiff, just the way you are now, at even a glimpse of the color burgundy. And finally, here at the end of the world, she understands why. She knows you better now than ever before in her life. And yet, to her, Shafa is the man who protected her from raiders and from her father. He is the man who soothed her when she was afraid, tucked her into bed at night. She has seen him fight his own brutal nature and the earth itself in order to be the parent she needs. He has helped her learn to love herself for what she is. Her mother, you, have done none of these things. And in that pent moment, as you fight past the memory of Inun falling to pieces and the burning ache of broken bones in a hand you no longer possess, with "Never say no to me" ringing in your head, she intuits the thing that you have until now denied. That it is hopeless. That there can be no relationship, no trust between you and her. Because the two of you are what the stillness and the season have made you. That Alabaster was right, and some things really are too broken to fix. Nothing to do but destroy them entirely for mercy's sake. Nasun shakes her head once while you stand there twitching. She looks away, shakes her head again. Her shoulders bow a little, not in a lazy slouch, but weariness. She does not blame you, but neither does she expect anything from you. And right now, you're just in the way. So she turns to walk away, and that shocks you out of your fugue. Nasun! He needs help, she says again. Her head is down, her shoulders tight. She doesn't stop walking. You inhale and start after her. I have to help him. You know what's happening. You felt it, feared it, all along. Behind you, you hear Danil stop the others. Maybe she thinks you and your daughter need space. You ignore them and run after Nasun. You grab her shoulder, try to turn her around. Nasun, what? She shrugs you off so hard that you stagger. Your balance has been shot since you lost the arm, and she's stronger than she was. She doesn't notice you almost fall. She keeps going.
Not soon.
She doesn't even look back. You're desperate to get her attention, to get her to react. Something, anything. You grope and then say to her back, I
know about Jija.
That makes her falter to a halt. Jija's death is still a raw wound within her that Shafa has cleaned and stitched, but that will not heal for some time. That you know what she has done makes her hunch in shame. That it was necessary self-defense frustrates her. That you have reminded her of this now tips the shame and frustration into anger. I have to help Shafa, she says again. Her shoulders are going up in a way that you recognize from 100 afternoons in your makeshift crucible, and from when she was 2 and learned the word no. There's no reasoning with her when she gets like this. Words become irrelevant. Actions mean more. But what actions could possibly convey the morass of your feelings right now? You look back at the others helplessly. Hjarka is holding Tonki back. Tonki's gaze is fixed on the sky and the assemblage there of more obelisks than you've seen in your whole life. Danil is a little apart from the rest, her hands behind her back, her black lips moving in what you recognized as a lorist mnemonic exercise to help her absorb everything she sees and hears verbatim. Lerna. You forgot. Lerna is not here. But if he were here, you suspect, he would be warning you. He was a doctor. Wounds of the family weren't really within his purview. But anyone can see that something here has festered. You trot after her again. Nasun! Nasun, Rustet! Look at me when I'm talking to you! She ignores you, and it's a slap in the face. The kind that clears your head, though, and not the kind that makes you want to fight. Okay. She won't hear you until she's helped. Shafa. You push past this thought, though it is like plodding through muck full of bones. Okay. Let me help you. This actually gets Nasun to slow down and then stop. Her expression is wary, so wary when she turns back. Help me? You look beyond her and see then that she was heading for another of the pylon buildings. This one with a broad railed staircase going up its sloping side. The view of the sky would be excellent at the top. Irrationally, you conclude that you have to keep her from going up there. Yes. You hold out your hand again. Please. Tell me what you need. I'll... Nasun. You're out of words. You're willing her to feel what you feel. Nasun. It's not working. She says, in a voice as hard as stone, I need to use the obelisk gate. You flinch. I told you this already, weeks ago, but apparently you did not believe. What? You can't! You're thinking, it will kill you. Her jaw tightens. I will. She's thinking, I don't need your permission. You shake your head, incredulous. To do what? But it's too late. She's done. You said you would help her, but then hesitated. She is Shafa's daughter, too, in her heart of hearts. Earth fires. 2 fathers, and you, of all people, to shape her. Is it any wonder that she's turned out the way she has? To her, hesitation is the same thing as no. She doesn't like it when people say no to her. So Nasun turns her back on you again and says, Don't follow me anymore, Mama. You immediately start after her again, of course. Nasun. She whips back around. She's in the ground. You sense it. And she's in the air. You see the lines of magic, and suddenly The two weave together in a way that you can't even comprehend. The stuff of Corpoint's ground, which is metals and pressed fibers and substances for which you have no name, layered over volcanic rock, heaves beneath your feet. Out of old habit, years spent containing your children's orogenic tantrums, you react even as you stagger, setting a torus into the ground that you can use to cancel her orogeny. It doesn't work, because she isn't just using orogeny. She cesses it, though, and her eyes narrow. Your gray eyes, like ash. And an instant later, a wall of obsidian slams up from the ground in front of you, tearing through the fiber and metal of the city's infrastructure, forming a barrier between you and her that spans the road. The force of this upheaval flings you to the ground. When the stars clear from your vision and the dust dissipates enough, you stare up at the wall in shock. Your daughter did this. To you. Someone grabs you and you flinch. It's Tonki. "I don't know if it's occurred to you," she says, hauling you to your feet. "But your child seems like she's got your temper. So, you know, maybe you shouldn't get too pushy." "I don't even know what she did," you murmur, dazed, though you nod thanks to Tonki for helping you up. "That wasn't... I don't..." There was no fulcrum-esque precision in what Nasun did, even though you taught her fulcrum fundamentals. You lay your hand against the wall in confusion, and feel the lingering flickers of magic within its substance, dancing from particle to particle as they fade. She's blending magic and orogeny. I've never seen that before. I have. We call it tuning. Meanwhile, no longer hampered by you, Nasun has climbed the pylon steps. She stands atop it now, surrounded by turning bright red warning symbols that dance in the air. A heavy, faintly sulfurous breeze wafts up from Corpoint's great hole, lifting the stray hairs from her twin plaits. She wonders if Father Earth is relieved to have manipulated her into sparing its life. Shafa will live if she turns every person in the world into stone eaters. That is all that matters. "First, the network," she says, lifting her eyes to the sky. The 27 obelisks flicker from solid to magic in unison as she reignites them. She spreads her hands before her. On the ground below her, you flinch as you cess, feel, or attuned to the lightning-fast activation of 27 obelisks. They act as one in this instant, thrumming so powerfully together that your teeth itch. You wonder why Tonki isn't grimacing the way you are. But Tonki is only a still. Tonki is not stupid, though, and this is her life's work. While you stare at your daughter in awe, she narrows her eyes at the obelisks. 3 cubed, she murmurs. You shake your head, mute. She glares at you, irritated by your slowness. "Well, if I was going to emulate a big crystal, I would start by putting smaller crystals into a cubiform lattice configuration." Then you understand. The big crystal that Nasun means to emulate is the onyx. You need a key to initialize the gate. That's what Alabaster told you. What Alabaster didn't tell you, the useless ass, was that there are many possible kinds of keys. When he tore the rifting across the stillness, he used a network composed of all the node maintainers in his vicinity, probably because the onyx itself would have turned him to stone at once. The node maintainers were a lesser substitute for the onyx, a spare key. You didn't know what you were doing that first time when you yoked the origins in Kastrima Under into a network. But he knew the onyx was too much for you to just grab directly back then. You didn't have Alabaster's flexibility or creativity. He taught you a safer way. Nasunzo, is the student Alabaster always wanted. She cannot have ever accessed the obelisk gate before. It's been yours till now. But as you observe in shock, in horror, she reaches beyond her spare key network, finding other obelisks one by one and binding them. It's slower than it would be with the onyx, but you can tell that it's just as effective. It's working. The appetite, connected and locked. The sardonyx, sending a little pulse from where it hovers out of sight, somewhere over the southern sea. The jade. Nasun will open the gate. You shove Tonki away. Get as far from me as you can, all of you. Tonki doesn't waste time arguing. Her eyes widen. She turns and runs. You hear her shouting to the others. You hear Danil arguing. And then you can no longer pay heed to them. Nasun will open the gate, turn to stone, and die. Only one thing can stop Nasun's network of obelisks. The onyx. You need to reach it first, though. And right now it's all the way on the other side of the planet, halfway between Kostrima and Renonis, where you left it. Once, long ago at Kostrima over, it called you to itself. But do you dare wait for it to do that now, with Nasun grabbing control of every part of the gate? You need to get to the onyx first. For that, you need magic. Much more of it than you can muster just by yourself, here without a single obelisk to your name. The beryl, the hematite, the iolite. She's going to die right in front of you if you don't do something. Frantically, you throw your awareness into the earth. Core Point sits on a volcano. Maybe you can... Wait. Something pulls your attention back up to the volcano's mouth. Underground, but closer by. Somewhere underneath this city, you sense a network. Lines of magic woven together, supporting one another, rooted deep to draw up more. It's faint, it's slow, and there is a familiar ugly buzz at the back of your mind when you touch this network. Buzz upon buzz upon buzz. Ah, yes. The network you found is guardians, nearly 1,000 of them, of rusting course. You have never consciously sought the magic of them before. But for the first time you understand what that buzz is. Some part of you, even before Alabaster's training, felt the foreignness of the magic within them. The knowledge sends a sharp, nearly paralyzing lance of fear through you. The network of them is close by, easy to grab. But if you do this, what's to stop all these guardians from boiling up out of Warrant like angry wasps from a disturbed nest? Don't you have enough problems? Nasun groans up on her pylon. To your shock, you can... Evil Earth, you can see the magic around her, in her, beginning to flare up like a fire hitting oiled kindling. She burns against your perception, the weight of her growing heavier upon the world by the instant. The kyanite, the orthoclase, the scapolite... And suddenly your fear is gone, because your baby needs you. So you set your feet, you reach for that network you found, guardians or no guardians. You growl through your teeth and grab everything. The guardians, the threads that trail from their sesapine away into the depths, and as much of the magic coming through these as you can pull. The iron shards themselves, tiny depositories of the evil Earth's will. You make it all yours, yoke it tight, and then you take it. And somewhere down in Warrant there are guardians screaming, coming awake and writhing in their cells and grabbing at their heads as you do to every single one of them, what Alabaster once did to his guardian. It is what Nasun yearned to do for Shafa. Only there is no kindness in the way you're doing it. You don't hate them. You just don't care. You snatch the iron from their brains and every bit of silvery light from between their cells. And as you feel them crystallize and die, you finally have enough magic from your makeshift network to reach the Onyx. It listens at your touch, far away above the ashscape of the stillness. You fall into it, diving desperately into the dark to make your case. Please, you beg. It considers the request. This is not in words or sensation. You simply know its consideration. It examines you in turn, your fear, your anger, your determination to put things right. Ah, this last has resonance. You know yourself examined again, more closely and with skepticism, since your last request was for something so frivolous. Merely wiping out a city? You, of all people, did not need the gate for that. What the Onyx finds within you, however, is something different this time. Fear for kin, fear of failure, the fear that accompanies all necessary change. And underneath it all, a driving need to make the world better. Somewhere far away, a billion dying things shiver as the Onyx utters a low earth-shaking blast of sound and comes online. Atop her pylon, beneath the pulse of the obelisks, Nasun feels that distant upcycling darkness as a warning. But she is too deep in her summoning. Too many obelisks now fill her. She cannot spare any attention from her work. And as each of the 216 remaining obelisks in turn submits to her, and as she opens her eyes to stare at the moon that she's going to let fly past untouched, and as she instead prepares to turn all the might of the great plutonic engine back upon the world and its people, to transform them as I was once transformed, she thinks of Shafa. Impossible to delude oneself in a moment like this. Impossible to see only what one wants to see, when the power to change the world ricochets through mind and soul and the spaces between cells. Oh, I learned this long before both of you. Impossible not to understand that Nasun has known Shafa for barely more than a year and does not truly know him, given how much of himself he has lost. Impossible not to realize that she clings to him, because she has nothing else. But through her determination, there is a glimmer of doubt in her mind. It is nothing more than that, barely even a thought, but it whispers, "Do you really have nothing else? Is there not one person in this world besides Shafa who cares about you?" And I watch Nasun hesitate, fingers curling and small face tightening in a frown, even as the obelisk gate weaves itself into completion. I watch the shiver of energies beyond comprehension as they begin to align within her. I lost the power to manipulate these energies tens of thousands of years ago, but I can still see them. The arcano-chemical lattice, what you think of as mere brown stone, and the energetic state that produces it, is forming nicely. I watch as you see this too, and understand instantly what it means. I watch you snarl and smash apart the wall between you and your daughter, not even noticing that your fingers have turned to stone as you do it. I watch you run to the foot of the pylon steps and shout at her, "Nasun!" And in response to your sudden, raw, incontrovertible demand, the Onyx blasts out of nowhere to appear overhead. The sound of it, a low bone-shaking blat, is titanic. The blast of air that it displaces is thunderous enough to knock both you and Nasun down, She cries out and slides down a few steps, coming dangerously close to losing her grip on the gate as the impact jolts her concentration. You cry out as the impact makes you notice your left forearm, which is stone, and collarbone, which is stone, and left foot and ankle. But you set your teeth. There is no pain in you anymore, save anguish for your daughter. No need within you but one. She has the gate, but you have the onyx. And as you look up at it, at the moon glaring through its murky translucence, ice-white iris in a scleral sea of black, you know what you have to do. With the onyx's help, you reach half a planet away and stab the fulcrum of your intention into the wound of the world. The rifting shudders as you demand every iota of its heat and kinetic churn, and you shudder beneath the flux of so much power that, for a moment, you think it's just going to vomit out of you as a column of lava consuming all. But the onyx is part of you too right now, indifferent to your convulsions, because you're doing that, flopping along the ground and frothing at the mouth. It takes and taps and balances the power of the rifting with an ease that humbles you. Automatically, it links into the obelisks so conveniently nearby, the network that Nossun assembled in order to try to replicate the onyx's power. But a replica has only power, no will, unlike the onyx. The network has no agenda. The onyx takes the 27 obelisks and immediately begins eating into the rest of Nasun's obelisk network. Here, though, its will is no longer paramount. Nasun feels it, fights it. She is just as determined as you, just as driven by love. You for her, and she for Shafa. I love you both. How can I not, after all this? I am still human after all, and this is a battle for the fate of the world. Such a terrible and magnificent thing to witness. It is a battle, though, line by line, tendril by tendril of magic. The titanic energies of the gate, of the rifting, whip and shiver around you both in a cylindrical aurora borealis of energies and colors. Visible light ranging to wavelengths beyond the spectrum. Those energies resonate in you, where the alignment is already complete and still oscillate in Nasun, though her waveform has begun to collapse. It is the onyx and the rifting versus the gate, you against her, and all Corpoint trembles with the sheer force of it all. In the dark halls of Warrant, among the jeweled corpses of the Guardians, walls groan and ceilings crack, spilling dirt and pebbles. Nasun is straining to pull the magic down from what's left of the gate, to target everyone around you, and everyone beyond them. And finally, finally, you understand that she's trying to turn everyone into rusting stone-eaters. You, meanwhile, have reached up to catch the moon and perhaps earn humanity a second chance. But for either of you to achieve your respective goals, you will need to claim both gate and onyx and the additional fuel that the rifting provides. It is a stalemate that cannot continue. The gate cannot maintain its connections forever. And the onyx cannot contain the chaos of the rifting forever. And two human beings, however powerful and strong-willed, cannot survive so much magic for long. And then it happens. You cry out as you feel a change, a snapping into line. Nasun, the magics of her substance are fully aligned. Her crystallization has begun. In desperation and pure instinct, you grab some of the energy that seeks to transform her and fling it away, though this only delays the inevitable. In the ocean, too near Corpoint, There is a deep judder that even the mountain stabilizers cannot contain. To the west, a mountain shaped like a knife jolts up from the ocean floor. To the east, another rises, hissing steam from the newness of its birth. Nasun, snarling in frustration, latches on to these as new sources of power, dragging the heat and violence from them. Both crack and crumble away. The stabilizers push the ocean flat, preventing tsunami. But they can do only so much. They were not built for this. Much more, and even Core Point will crumble. Nasun! You shout again, anguished. She cannot hear you, but you see, even from where you are, that the fingers of her left hand have turned as brown and stony as your own. She is aware of it, you know somehow. She made this choice. She is prepared for the inevitability of her own death. You aren't. Oh, Earth, you just can't watch another of your children die. So, you give up. I ache with the look on your face, because I know what it costs you to give up Alabaster's dream and your own. You so wanted to make a better world for Nasun. But more than anything else, you want this last child of yours to live. And so you make a choice. To keep fighting will kill you both. The only way to win, then, is not to fight anymore. I'm sorry, Essun. I'm so sorry. Goodbye. Nasun gasps, her eyes snapping open, as she feels your pressure upon the gate. Upon her, while you dragged all of the terrible transforming curls of magic toward yourself. Suddenly relax. The onyx pauses in its onslaught, shimmering in tandem with the dozens of obelisks it has claimed. It is full of power that must be expended. For the moment, however, it holds. The stabilizing magics finally settle the churning ocean around Core Point. For this one pent moment, the world waits, still and taut. She turns. Nasun, you say. It's a whisper. You're on the bottom steps of the pylon trying to reach her. But that won't be happening. Your arm has completely solidified, and your torso is going. Your stone foot slides uselessly on the slick material, then locks as the rest of your leg freezes up. With your good foot, you can still push, but the stone of you is heavy. As crawling goes, you're not doing a very good job of it. Her brow furrows. You look up at her, and it strikes you. Your little girl, so big, here beneath the onyx and the moon. So powerful, so beautiful. And you cannot help it. You burst into tears at the sight of her. You laugh, though one of your lungs has gone to stone, and it's only a soft wheeze instead. So rusting amazing, your little girl. You are proud to lose to her strength. She inhales, her eyes widening as if she cannot believe what she is seeing. Her mother, so fearsome, on the ground, trying to crawl on stone limbs, face wet with tears, smiling. You have never, ever smiled at her before. And then the line of transformation moves over your face, and you are gone. Still there physically. A brown sandstone lump frozen on the lower steps, with only the barest suggestion of a smile on half-formed lips. Your tears are still there, glistening upon stone. She stares at these. She stares at these, and sucks in a long, hollow breath, because suddenly there is nothing, nothing, inside her.
She has killed her father, and she has killed her mother, and Shafa is dying, and there is nothing left. Nothing. The world just takes and takes and takes from her and leaves nothing. But she cannot stop staring at your drying tears. Because the world took and took and took from you too, after all. She knows this. And yet, for some reason that she does not think she'll ever understand, even as you died, you were reaching for the moon. And for her. She screams, clutches her head in her hands, one of them now halfway stone, drops to her knees, crushed beneath the weight of grief as if it is an entire planet. The onyx, patient but not, aware but indifferent, touches her. She is the only remaining component of the gate that has a functioning complementary will. Through this touch, she perceives your plan as commands, locked and aimed, but unfired. Open the gate. Pour the rifting's power through it. Catch the moon. End the seasons. Fix the world. This, Nasun Sesses feels, knows, was your last wish. The onyx says in its ponderous, wordless way, execute, yes or no. And in the cold stone silence alone, Nasun chooses. Yes. Coda. Me and you. You are dead, but not you. The recapture of the moon is undramatic from the perspective of the people standing beneath it. At the top of the apartment building where Tonki and the others have taken shelter, she's used an ancient writing instrument, long gone dry, but resurrected with a bit of spit and blood at the tip, to try to track the moon's movement between 1 hour and the next. It doesn't help, because she hasn't observed enough variables to do the math correctly, and because she's not some rusting hack astronomist for Earth's sake. She also isn't sure if she got the first measurement right, because of the fiver or sixer shake that occurred right around that moment, just before Kjarka dragged her away from the window. Obelisk builder windows don't shatter. She complains afterward. My rusting temper does, Kjarka retorts. And that ends the argument before it can begin. Tonki is learning to compromise for the sake of a healthy relationship. But the moon has indeed changed, they see, as days and then weeks pass. It does not vanish. It fluxes through shapes and colors in a pattern that does not initially make sense. But it grows no smaller in the sky on successive nights. The dismantling of the obelisk gate is somewhat more dramatic. Having expended its full capability in the achievement of something just as powerful as Geo-Arcanity, the gate proceeds as designed through its shutdown protocol. One by one, the dozens of obelisks floating around the world drift toward Core Point. One by one, the obelisks, wholly dematerialized now, all quantum states sublimated into potential energy. You need not understand it beyond that. Drop into the black chasm. This takes several days. The onyx, however, last and greatest of the obelisks, instead drifts out to sea, its hum deepening as its altitude decreases. It enters the sea gently, on a pre-planned course to minimize damage, since unlike its fellow obelisks, it alone has retained material existence. This, as the conductors long ago intended, preserves the onyx against future need. It also puts the last remnants of the Nies to rest, finally, deep in a watery grave. I suppose we must hope that no intrepid young future origin ever finds and raises it. Tonki is the one to go and find Nasun. It's later in the morning,
some hours after your death, under a sun that has risen bright and warm in the ashless blue sky. After pausing for a moment to stare at this sky in wonder and longing and fascination, Tonki goes back to the edge of the hole and to the pylon stair. Nasun's still there, sitting on one of the lower steps next to the brown lump of you. Her knees are drawn up, her head bowed, her completely solidified hand, frozen in the splayed gesture that she used while activating the gate, resting awkwardly on the step beside her. Tonki sits down on your other side, gazing at you for a long moment. Nasun starts and looks up as she becomes aware of another presence. But Tonki only smiles at her and awkwardly rests a hand on what was once your hair. Nasun swallows hard, scrubs at the dried tear tracks on her face, and then nods to Tonki. They sit together, with you, grieving for a time. Danil is the one who goes with Nasun later to fetch Shafa from the dead darkness of Warren. The other guardians, who still have core stones, have turned to jewel. Most seem to have simply died where they lay, though some fell out of their cells in the thrashing, and their glittering bodies sprawl awkwardly against the wall or along the floor. Shafa alone still lives. He's disoriented, weak, as Danil and Nasun help him back up into the surface light. It becomes clear that his hacked-off hair is already streaked with gray. Danil is worried about the stitched wound on the back of his neck, though it has stopped bleeding and seems to cause Shafa no pain. That isn't what's going to kill him. Nevertheless, once he's capable of standing and the sun has helped to clear his mind somewhat, Shafa holds Nasun there beside what remains of you. She doesn't weep. Mostly, she's just numb. The others come out, Tonki and Hjarka joining Danil, and they stand with Shafa and Nasun while the sun sets and the moon rises again. Maybe it's a silent memorial service. Maybe they just need time and company to recover from events too vast and strange to comprehend. I don't know. Elsewhere in Core Point, in a garden long since gone to Wild Meadow, I and Gewa face Remhwa, Seal, Greyman, whatever, beneath the now waning moon. He's been here since Nasun made her choice. When he finally speaks, I find myself thinking that his voice has become so thin and weary. Once, he made the very stones ripple with the wry-edged humor of his earth talk. Now he sounds old. Thousands of years of ceaseless existence will do that to a man. He says, "I only wanted it to end." Gehua, antimony, whatever, says, "That isn't what we were made for." He turns his head slowly to look at her. It is tiring just to watch him do this, stubborn fool. There is the despair of ages on his face, all because he refuses to admit that there's more than one way to be human. Gehua offers a hand. "We were made to make the world better." Her gaze slides to me for support. I sigh inwardly, but offer a hand in truce as well. Remhwa looks at our hands, somewhere perhaps among the others of our kind who have gathered to watch this moment, are Bimnihwa and Dushwa and Salehwa. They forgot who they were long ago, or else they simply prefer to embrace who they are now. Only we three have retained anything of the past. This is both a good and bad thing.
"I'm tired,"
he admits. "A nap might help, I suggest. There is the onyx, after all." Well, something of the old Remhwa remains. I don't think I deserved that look. But he takes our hands,
together the three of us, and the others too, all who have come to understand that the world has to change, the war must end, descend into the boiling depths. The heart of the world is quieter than usual, we